greetings everyone and welcome to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about The Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on War is a Racket by Smedley Butler when we come back. You know Charles Lyell? Well, Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology. He published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely held and accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood can be strictly ruled out. This process is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. It was a Newswire report back in the 1980s that made the surprising statement. The sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Well, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then that totals 1% per millennium. And if the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, then it would have been double its present diameter. Then if we project it back, you know, like we're supposed to in the Lyell formula, if we go back just 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth because it would be 93 million miles in diameter. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun, sometime back around the Big Bang. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? Do you remember that? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? So 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs became extinct, but 20 million years ago, the sun was 93 million miles in diameter and would have reached the orbit of the Earth. Hey kids, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on this kind of a pseudo-scientific lie. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda masquerading as science. And this is one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been exploring the concepts that were espoused back before World War II in neutrality. Now, as we all know from history, the neutrality side lost. And we went with the war side, so we had, and we went ahead and participated in World War II. We don't know how neutrality would have worked out over the past 60 or 70 years had we stayed out of World War II. Maybe it would have been worse for the world. Hitler would have come over here and destroyed us and taken us. We'd all be speaking German today. That's what they tell us. Well, the other side of the coin, though, was pretty compelling, I thought, from the point of view of this three-star general. You know, his name was Smedley Butler. And if you'll remember, some pretty high-ranking generals Here, just prior to the war on Iraq, they said, no, this war in Iraq is not being thought out very well, and we think it's going to take a 500,000 men. See, there was a fella at the time, you know, back about 2002, you know, before the war with Iraq. I've forgotten his name now. He was a Russian fella, I think. Had an odd name. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he disagreed with Donald Rumsfeld. He said, no, that isn't going to work. This plan that you got here is, sucks like an armpit. And, he got fired for that. He didn't last long in the job. And now, recently, a number of retired generals, and a number of generals have retired over this war in Iraq. You know, they're pretty nice guys, and they go along to get along, but, you know, they didn't like the program that was going on there, and they've been speaking out against that. Now, there was a time in America when the civilian leadership listened to the military people. And that's what I've been doing here. This guy, Smedley Butler, said, you know, in any attack on the United States, they couldn't possibly hope to succeed with less than a million-man army. Well, that's what we did when we invaded Europe during World War II. We had a launching pad 20 miles from the French coast. And we had 3 years to build up, and we're only 20 miles away, and we launched thousands of ships and airplanes and great air forces from 20 miles away, and we succeeded with that million-man invasion. But the Germans would have to do it in reverse. They'd have to leave Germany and travel 3,000 miles across the ocean and stage that same landing without any ports, without any friendly land 25 miles from New York City to land on, and they'd have to carry that out, and they would have to bring with them, 270-day supply. And it was 7 tons per man, so they'd have to have 7 million tons of supplies. And he said, there aren't enough ships in the world to haul all of that distance. So, this general, you know, looking at the logistics of the German problem of attacking the United States of America was pretty formidable. Now, you'll notice that the Arabs, when they came over here, they attacked 3 or 4 of our buildings over here. They actually didn't cause a whole lot of damage. I mean, it wasn't like we went over to Berlin and laid waste to the whole city of Berlin with our strategic 8th Air Force strategic bombing. I mean, okay, they knocked down a couple of buildings, but that wasn't exactly like destroying New York City. Pretty neat raid. You got to give them credit for that, or whoever it was that put the raid on. I'm not really sure it was the Arabs that did that. I kind of suspect that it was our own CIA that did it, because it sounded like a false flag operation to me. And quite a few guys have put out some good tapes on that. You know, the Power Hour has. And Von Kleist and his wife, Dave Von Kleist and Joyce, I think, did a hell of a job. I got their tape. I thought that they just covered all the bases just about as well as you could. And then I saw one the other day. It was by Alex Jones, and I thought, by God, you know, that Alex Jones just kind of hit the nail right on the head there. They didn't think that the Arabs did that, or those Al-Qaeda guys did that. They thought it was a little better planned out job by the CIA. Be that as it may. The other side in World War II, that is the peace side, that is the pacifist side, the neutrality side over here, wasn't necessarily led by or headed by this guy Butler, but he was certainly in on it. I remember my granddad was one of them. He said, to hell with the Europeans. Let's look out for ourselves and take care of America. Now, of course, we all know that the other side won the game, and here's where the world is today, because America has built a gigantic empire in which our troops are billets to now in 126 countries around the world. And with empire comes responsibility, comes expenses, comes wars. I mean, you know, if that's what you want, that's what you got to pay for. Now, in the past, there have been great world ruling empires, you know, like the Roman Empire and the Egyptians and the Babylonians. And all of these people, in turn, have decayed and rotted from within and then collapsed and then gone into national captivity. Every one of them, without exception. Every one of them. Gibbons, the guy that wrote the book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbons, back in 1776, I believe it was, when he wrote the book, outlined five basic causes for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. All five of those causes are in full force and effect now. The corruption that you just saw in the elected body, our Congress, was endemic in the Roman Empire and in every empire in the past. Empires become extremely corrupt. And this empire, the American Empire, is just going through the corrupt stage. Before we collapse and go into national captivity, we're there. They all debased their currency. They all did that, without exception, and every single one of them paid for it. We've done that. We've debased our currency. Our money is worth nothing. Well, compared to what it was worth. I mean, it's just monopoly money. And as a result of that, there's another nail in our coffin. And then we've turned against our God. That's the one that's going to be our Achilles heel. Because the same God that has preserved us for 200 years is just about to drop the hammer on us. And he's not silent about it either. You know, he's been pretty vociferous. There's nobody listening to him. But it wasn't because he wasn't talking loud and clear and pretty plain. And he's talking very loud and clear and plain in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 when he says, hey, troops, gather around, because here's the way this is coming down. Here's what I'm going to do to you if you give me the finger. Now, we've been giving him the finger for about the last 50 years or so. And it's getting worse with every day. You know, every day that goes by, we get a little bit worse. And there's a limit to that. I don't know just where that limit is, but he met his limit at the Red Sea crossing, and he met his limit at Sodom and Gomorrah, just to name a couple. He met his limit at Jericho. And there's times in history when this guy comes unhinged, this God, this creator God, he comes unhinged, flies off the handles, and when he starts bouncing off the ceiling and flying off the walls, all hell breaks loose. And I'm fearful that that's about to happen here in the United States. Now, our president's talking about war with Iran and North Korea. He's talking about war with Venezuela. And as I've pointed out, this guy Smedley Butler pointed out, hey, listen, the war is immensely popular. We're going to have wars as long as there's profit. And there's immense profits in war. You can just count on more war. You can count on war with Iran. And if it's not Iran, then we'll go find somebody else. But we're going to go to war against somebody because we're spending $500 billion a year. That's $500 billion a year. We're talking about as much money as we spend on education every year at all levels in this country. We spend on war. That's more money than all the rest of the people in the world combined spend on war. Hey, we're not spending all this money on war to train these people to be ballet dancers. I mean, these guys aren't flying these stealth airplanes, you know, because they're not trained to kill. And they're gonna kill somebody. Somebody's gotta pay because there's profits to be made. Now, you and I may want peace, but that's the minority view, and this guy, Butler, is in the minority view. But boy, he came up with some pretty neat ideas. I kinda like this. He said, this war in Europe, it isn't over here, and it won't come over here unless we invite it. And the best way to invite it was to raise this embargo and sell bombs and ammunition. They'll have the stamp of American bankers on them, and they have an RSVP that'll bring out that invitation and an invitation to go over there and join in that mess. And then he talks about the boogeyman. No, but the boogeyman is that someone will come over here. And he said, you know, we ought not to be alarmed about that. No one in Europe can afford to leave home. If Hitler were to leave Germany with 1 million men to go anywhere, if he ever got back, he'd find everybody speaking French or Russian. Those babies wouldn't move, those babies, he says, would move in on him while he was gone. No, there isn't a single crazy war dog that can come over here, and we can build a defense of our own country that not even a rat, much less a mad dog, could creep through. That was his advice in 1939. So he says, let's be consistent. We cry to high heaven that we're a God-fearing and peace-loving nation, and therefore we don't believe in shooting people, bombing their homes, knocking down their cities with cannon. And we really are a God-fearing and peace-loving nation. But certainly it's ungodly, hypocritical, and unmanly of us to say to the British and the French, you know, we agree with you that we're against this fellow Hitler, But being God-fearing and all, we can't shoot him. We can't bomb him. But we'll be delighted to see you do it. And we'll furnish you the guns and the bombs. That is, provided you pay us double, of course, what they're really worth, so that we can make our profits over here. And in order that there may be no mistake about it this time, you'll pay us in advance. You see, we're against going to war ourselves, but we're not against your going to war. You go ahead, and we'll sell you all the stuff you need. You know, that kind of hypocrisy, boys and girls, is the kind of hypocrisy that we used in both World War I from 1914 to 17 and in World War II from 39 to 41. I mean, we were supplying the British. We were out there just supplying. Then we had an oil embargo on the Japanese. Those are warlike acts, you know. And sure enough, when you do these kinds of things, you get the other side riled up, and then the other side attacks you. And, of course, that's what we wanted them to do. Now, today, we don't need the other side to attack us. President Bush has come up with a new policy. It's called preemption. We'll go attack them before they can attack us. Well, that's got all the trappings of empire. Empires do that. You know, when people get insolent to them, the emperor, the umpire, they go out there and they straighten out these people, you know, that give them some lip. And those North Koreans have been giving us a lot of lip. And the president's been telling them right along, you know, you better lighten up over there. We're going to come over there and clean your clock. And so they're over there just busily making nuclear weapons as fast as they can because they're really afraid. I think they're really afraid. I think they ought to be really afraid that we're going to come over there and clean their clock. And I don't think with nuclear weapons it'll take us very long to do that. And I'm pretty sure that they're afraid that that's about what we're going to do. Now, the majority of the people in this country are against Hitler. Now, this is Butler again, 1939. Says the majority of people in this country are against Hitler. But they don't want to get into this war in Europe. Our people think the best way to stay out of it is to be neutral. Now, how is it proposed to stay neutral? Why, by regulating the sale of our products. It was satisfactorily proven that the sale of munitions to the Allies in 1914, 15, and 16 got us into World War I. Now, by selling again, we run the same risks. If the sale of products has a tendency to involve us, certainly the more we sell, the greater the risk of getting in. The more we sell, the greater the business and the profits. And the greater the profits, the greater our interest in the success of the customer. Our business slogan is, the customer is always right, isn't it? Now, the embargo on the sale of munitions certainly limited the volume of our sales. It most certainly cut out blood money. So why did we raise it? Why did we open the gate and run greater risk? Why? Well, to make sure that Hitler is licked. But then, we should not be neutral, and we have pinned our hopes of staying out on our being neutral. It certainly does not make any sense, then, to raise the embargo and try to stay neutral at the same time. Put another way, hey, if you're going to sell arms to the British, you got to sell arms to the Germans. You got to sell them to everybody. You know, business is business. Now, President Roosevelt wanted to get into the war in the worst way. And you can't blame him. I mean, after all, business is business. It's nothing personal. But World War II cost us about a quarter of a million dead, as I recall, about a half a million casualties, 11 million men under arms, and about $200 billion worth of treasure. Now, that was a pretty expensive enterprise. And when it was all said and done, then we turned around and gave the Philippines away to the Filipinos. Now, why we spend all that money on the Philippines to give it away? I mean, we could have done that back in 1900. I mean, all we had to do is walk out of there, mind our own business, let the Filipinos do their thing in life, and we'd have been $600 million richer, and we'd have a lot more friends, probably. You know, we didn't endear those Filipinos to us. We fought a bloody war with them for about 7 or 8 years, killed them by the tens of thousands. But then, you know, that's the price of empire. Price of empire, you know, take some bodies with it. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had some pretty stringent rules, regulations, customs, usages, and practices as it related to war. He's not a pacifist. Not a pacifist at all. I mean, you just take a look at Sodom and Gomorrah and see if this God is not a pacifist. Take a look at Jericho. That's no pacifist there. When you wipe out the whole Egyptian army, you know, in a death trap called the Red Sea Crossing, that's not a pacifist. This God is all in favor of war, but he makes them pretty short, violent, and to the point. The entire Egyptian campaign at the Red Sea Crossing took about 20 minutes. And it killed about 500,000 Egyptians. 500,000 in 20 minutes. Now that's a short war. It's very violent, right to the point. And when it was all said and done, the war is over, and the will of God has clearly been shown. Same thing happened there at Jericho. The walls fell down. It took about a week on that campaign. It was about a 7-day campaign. On the last day, the walls fell down. The Israelites went in, killed every man, woman, and child in the city. Now that's genocide. And we got a convention against genocide. Do you remember that? So the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not only is he short and to the point when it comes to war, he's a genocidal maniac on top of it. And I don't think he's apologizing for it either. But when you kill every man, woman, and child, if that doesn't sound like genocide, then I don't know what does. It sounded kind of genocidal to me. And he didn't do that just once or twice. You know, he instructed our forefathers to do that with regularity. He said, I don't want anybody left alive breathing air. Kill them all, from the oldest to the youngest. And we'll cover that next time when we get into this thing of the laws on war. But Butler goes on to say, also, the time has come when we have to answer the big question before us. How often are we going to go over there and bail them out in Europe? Will we have to do it every 25 years? In addition to going ourselves last time, are we going to send our children today? Are we going to be ready to send our grandchildren 25 years from now? Isn't it time to make a stand about this thing of war in Europe here and now? Are we so vitally interested right now that we want to contribute 5 million of the finest and strongest boys that the great mothers of America have produced? Are you mothers and fathers so deeply concerned that you want to furnish your sons as cannon fodder? And also, let's look at this question from a personal viewpoint, which is really the only way to look at it. It's the way that counts in the long run. It's all very well, and it's very high-sounding to say the government declares war, to say helplessly as individuals we have nothing to do with it, we can't prevent it. But who are we? Well, we, right now, are the mothers and fathers of every able-bodied boy of military age in the United States. And we're also you young men of voting age and over that we'll be using for cannon fodder. And you know, we can prevent this if we put our minds to it. Now, you mothers in particular can put an end to it. Now, the only way you can resist all this war hysteria and beating the tom-toms for more war in Europe is by hanging on to the love that you bear to your boys. And when you listen to some well-worded, well-delivered war speech, you want to remember that it's nothing but sound. It's your boy that matters. And no matter of sound can make up to you for the loss of your son after he's been killed or maimed in war. And after you've heard one of these speeches and your blood is all hot and you want to go and hit somebody like Hitler, why don't you go upstairs where your boy is asleep and go into his bedroom and you'll find him lying there, his pillows all messed up, covers all tangled, sleeping away so hard. Just take a look at him. Put your hand on that spot at the back of his neck and place the place you used to love and kiss him when he was a baby and stroke him a little bit. You probably won't wake him up. He knows it's you. Just look at this strong, fine young body, because only the best and the brightest boys are chosen for war. And look at this splendid young creature who's part of yourself. You brought him into the world. You cared for him. The boy relies on you. You taught him to do that, didn't you? Now I ask you, are you going to run out on him? Are you going to let somebody beat a drum or blow a bugle and make him chase after it and be killed or crippled in a foreign land? Are you, the mothers of America, ashamed to make this fight to stay out of this European war on the ground of their love for their sons? For what better ground could there be? And have you ever been in on one of those huge veterans' hospitals It's been necessary for us to build to take care of the thousands of helpless and maimed cripples that are still with us from the last war in Europe. Because if you have, you will not need a reminder of what war can and will do to your boy. How it can render his life useless and broken at age 20, and yet keep him cruelly alive for the whole span of his life if he lives to be 70 or 80. Because if you have not, then I advise you to go and see one of them for yourselves. Because nothing could bring home to you more clearly, or more tragically, the fact that in the last analysis, it is your boy who is going to pay the piper. Because there are who came back entirely unscathed, or few rather, there are that came back entirely unscathed, and some came back in such a way that you would find yourself praying for their release from pain. It would have been better had they been killed. Those withered, elderly, spiritless men who lie and sit so patiently in their wards, in the veterans' hospitals, day after day, in those hospitals, waiting for the end to come, as they have waited since they got there 20 years ago. They were the flower of our boys in their time. It's not age that has brought them to this pass, because their average age is a little over 40. It is war that brought them to this place. And like the unknown soldier, who was one of them, they too had mothers. They too had fathers who felt toward them as you do about your son. And thank God this is a democracy, and by your voice and by your vote, you can save your boy. You are the bosses of this country, you mothers and you fathers. And that brings up another point. If you let this country go into a European war, you will lose this democracy, and don't forget that. Yeah, I'm going to underline that. I want to come back. If you let this country go into another European war, you're going to lose this democracy, and don't forget that. Hey, kids, that's a truism. We went into communism after World War II. We Americans practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. All 10 planks. Total control of our government is now in the hands of multinational corporations and lobbyists. Now, the other day, you voted the bad guys, the Republicans, out, and you voted the bad guys, the Democrats, back in. I say the bad guys back in. Have you people forgotten that you voted the Democrats out 12 years ago? Because they were taking bribes. Because they were the bad guys. They were the corrupt and the corruptors in 1994. Do you remember that? So you voted those bad guys out. And then you voted the good guys, the Republicans, in. And in 12 years' time, the Republicans made a farce out of the graft and corruption of the Democrats. And so now you voted out the bad guys, the Republicans. Now you voted out the bad guys, the Democrats, in 94, and the bad guys, the Republicans, in 06. Who did you replace the Democrats with? Well, the same bad guys that you voted out back in 54. Do you remember that? And then when you voted the bad guys out, the Republicans, in 54, don't you remember you voted the Republicans in 46 because of the bad guys that had conducted the war so poorly during World War II and that had lied to you in 1940? And President Roosevelt said to you that as long as I am your president, no American son will fight on foreign soil. That's what Roosevelt ran on in 1940. And a year later, we're at war. You know, I just point that out for your consideration. This isn't a Republican thing. This isn't a Democratic thing. This is a business thing. It doesn't make any difference who you vote in. Boys and girls, you're going to have more war. You're going to have war with Iran and North Korea, whether you got Republicans or Democrats running your government. It doesn't make any difference. Make up your minds to it. You're going to have more war. And furthermore, that's what your God warned you that you were going to have when you kicked him out back in 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel, I'm going to write this down, all you Christians out there. 1 Samuel chapter 8, this is where you gave your God the finger and said, get out of here, get out of our lives, butt out of our business. And he did. He's a nice guy. He said, are you really sure this is what you want? And we said, nevertheless, You bet that's what we want. Nevertheless, we said, we'll have a king to rule over us. You know, our God said, okay, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success, kids. But he gave us a warning right then. He said, now this will be the manner of your king. He's going to create a military-industrial complex, and your sons and daughters are going to beat their plowshares into swords, and they'll go fight in his wars. And you'll pay the taxes to support it. And then he said, when you get tired of that king that you have set over you, that's the king that we Americans set over us, and you cry out to me, in that day I will not hear you. So if you Christians are out here praying to Jesus to save you from George Bush, you ought to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8 and read the answer to the riddle, because he said, I ain't hearing this crap. Now, there's a solution to the problem, and I think Butler pretty well hit the nail on the head. I don't think he's a religious guy by any stretch of the imagination. I never heard him invoke the Word of God or the Bible or any laws from the Scripture that we need to make any fundamental changes. He came up with some pretty neat ideas, I thought, that were scripturally based, but he never mentioned the Scripture, to my knowledge. One of the first things he said was, you take the profit out of it and you can take the war out of it. As long as there's profit in it, you're going to have war. As long as there's profit in drugs, you're going to have drugs. Boys and girls, there's immense profits in drugs, both legal and illegal drugs. Immense profits. You're going to have drugs coming out your earballs from now on. There'll be no end to drugs. And by the way, in case you didn't know this, 82% of Americans, this is really a staggering number I just saw the other day, 82% of Americans take one prescription drug. Oh my God. Boys and girls, prescription drugs are pretty heavy duty stuff, you know. I mean, that's like cocaine, heroin, you know, it's pretty heavy duty. 82%. Only 18% of Americans don't take any drugs at all. Now, when you get to be age 65 or over, then the number jumps pretty dramatically. For that group of people, they're on average taking 6 prescription drugs. 6! All you older people, you know, you old folks, I don't count myself in the group, I'm not into the drug scene. You guys are taking 6 drugs. I suppose when it's averaged out, you know, there's probably less than 82% total that are taking one prescription drug, but it sounded like to me when I read the statistic that 82 people out of 100 are taking one prescription drug, and then it gets worse as you get older. You take more prescription drugs as you get older. Hey, there's a lot of money involved in that, and you're going to have lobbying and advertising and government collusion and government participation in the drug scene. You do now, and you're going to continue to. Same thing with war. We could do away with it if we wanted to, but we don't. Americans don't want to do away with drugs. We're all in favor of drugs. Everybody loves drugs. We could do away with war if we wanted to, but we don't want to. We want war. War. You know, just tell somebody that you want to close the military base. Let's say Travis Air Force Base or McClellan Air Force Base or you know, we want to close down Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And you listen to those people around Fort Bragg start complaining about, oh my God, no, never. Just go down to Fort Bliss, Texas and say, let's close down this army base here at Fort Bliss and let's start working on more peace and less war. And see what the people down there in Texas have to say about closing that base. They're all in favor of closing bases, but not ours. That's the bottom line. Don't close ours. And then, of course, some general, he jumps up and he says, oh, my God, we can't close our base at Fort Bliss unless the Russians close their base at Vladivostok or something, you know. Well, the Russians aren't about to do that. But then, you know, we're not about to invade Russia, and Russia's not about to invade the United States. But the Russian generals are all telling their guys, hey, we got to be prepared for an attack by the Americans. And the Americans are all saying, hey, we got to be prepared for an attack by the Russians. And the truth of the matter is, as we've already seen, there isn't an army in the world that can attack the United States of America. And listen, Napoleon attacked Russia, and Hitler attacked Russia, and Russia just swallowed them up. Now listen, boys and girls, learn a lesson from Afghanistan. The greatest empire in the history of the world, the British Empire, attacked Afghanistan and got whipped. They couldn't subdue the Afghanis. And then the second greatest empire in the history of the world, the Soviet Union, attacked Afghanistan, and they got whipped. And so here comes the Americans, after the two greatest empires in the history of the world have attacked Afghanistan, and we're right in there attacking them Afghanis over there, and we're in the process of getting our ass kicked again. Can you believe it? There's an old adage that says, you know, if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it. You know, you'd have thought we'd have watched, you know, those British over there. Now, those British guys, they're no pikers now. Don't you kid yourself that those British weren't the finest soldiers that God ever put breath into when they took on the Afghanis. They couldn't subdue them. And the Russians over there, they had the best machinery and equipment that you can imagine. And they couldn't subdue them in 1989. And then here comes the Americans, and you think we're going to do it, huh? Okay, well, get after it, boys and girls, if you think you can do it where the other guys couldn't. But when you get all through, and let's assume that you're successful, you get all through, and you spend your billions and billions of dollars on Afghanistan, and you subdue them. What have you gained when you get all through with the project? How much money have you made? How successful were you? Now, if you want to find out how successful you are in the drug trade, you want to remember that the Taliban, you know, that's those bad guys over there that we had to throw out because we needed a regime change because they wouldn't let the Unocal Corporation build a pipeline through Afghanistan, say to Pakistan. They said, no, we're not going to let you do that. And that's why we needed regime change in Afghanistan. But in addition to that, when we got over there, we found that the Taliban had virtually wiped out the heroin poppy trade. Well, listen, this year, 2006, this is the biggest poppy crop in the history of Afghanistan. We're going to produce more heroin in Afghanistan under the American occupation than has ever been produced in that country in its history. And we're the country that's opposed to drugs. Excuse me. Before we got involved in Afghanistan, they were out of the heroin business. Once we got involved in Afghanistan, we have now created the biggest heroin crop in history, and the price of heroin on the street is nosediving. The price of heroin is the lowest in history right now, today. Now, isn't that just real special? Hey, but that just goes to prove the power of the free marketplace, doesn't it? Hey, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse, and we recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law or an editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. I should remind you that we are reviewing the book that's called War's Racket by Smedley Butler. Kind of an odd name. It's the only guy I've ever heard of named Smedley. I've heard that name a time or two in Walt Disney, you know. It's kind of like Scrooge, the name Smedley. Not to make fun of the man's name, it's just an unusual name. I haven't heard that name on anybody except this guy who happens to be, of all things, a three-star Marine General. I mean, this is a killer of killers. When you're a Marine, kids, this is a step above an ordinary killer that we find in the Army or the Navy or maybe the Coast Guard. I mean, these guys are trained killers of killers. And this guy is a general of the killers. And he comes back from the Great War, you know, World War I. He comes back from Nicaragua and Haiti and a number of other places where he says that he was the guy that was out here fighting to make the world safe for the United Fruit Company and a bunch of other guys. I'll cover that with you a little later. But anyway, he said, if you let this country go into a European war, you're going to lose your democracy. Or this democracy, and don't forget that. And as you stand by your boy in bed, he is safe. But here is another picture. It may help you to build up resistance against all this war propaganda, which will almost drown you. Somewhere in a muddy trench, thousands of miles away from you and your home, your son, the same one that's sleeping so sweetly and safely in his bed with you at his side, is waiting to go over the top. And just before dawn, drizzling rain, dark and dismal, face caked with mud and tears, so homesick and longing for you and home. He thinks of you on your knees, praying for him. He's frightened to death, but still more scared the boy next to him will discover his terror. That's your son. That's your boy. His stomach as big as an egg. I know, because I've had that sensation many times. Now, do you want him to be the next unknown soldier? The unknown soldier had a mother, you know, and a father. He didn't just appear out of thin air. Do you want your son tangled in the barbed wire or struggling for his last gasp of breath in a stinking trench somewhere abroad? Do you want him to cry out, "Mother, Father, why did you let them do it to me?" Now think it over, my dear fellow Americans. Can't we be satisfied with defending our own homes, defending our own women, and defending our own children right here in America? Now, there are only two reasons why you should ever be asked to give your youngsters. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the defense of our Bill of Rights, and particularly the right to worship God as we see fit. And every other reason advanced for the murder of young men, every other reason advanced for war is a racket, pure and simple. Smedley Butler said that. Well, he's got a pretty good argument, and I kind of liked his argument. And had I been an adult in 1937 or 38 or 39 when this man was retired from the military, and if I'd have been listening to him give a speech, I would have clapped loudly for him, and I would have joined his cause. The losing cause, of course. Because the losing cause is always the cause of peace. Well, can you name a time when peace ever won out over war? Not in the 20th century in World War I or World War II or Vietnam or Korea. Now, just think about Korea for a minute. I remember as a little kid, as 11 years old, delivering newspapers, and it was on June 25th, 1950. And I'm sitting here rolling my newspapers, and war in Korea, just three words, war in Korea. That was the headline in the Humboldt Standard on June 25th, 1950. It announced that there was now war in Korea. And we were sitting over here saying, Korea, where is Korea? I'm 11 years old. I couldn't find Korea on a map at high noon with both hands. And neither could my parents. I said, we're at war in Korea? Well, no, we're not at war in Korea, but the North Koreans have attacked the South Koreans. And the story, you know, explained, you know, where Korea is. It's over by Japan, and General MacArthur is in Japan, and when they finish conquering South Korea, are they then going to attack Japan, and are we going to be involved in a war with the Koreans? Now listen, the Koreans had a mission. They wanted to unify their country, and it had been split in half because of World War II, split in half. If the United States of America had been split in half because of a war, you know, the one half might want to join the other half. But, you know, the Southerners might not be too inclined to want to join the Northerners, but the Northerners might be more inclined to want to join the Southerners. That's the way it was in our country, in our own Civil War. And so here was a civil war between North and South Korea, and the United Nations and the United States got involved in that war. And you know, at the time, it made all the sense in the world because, you know, this is our war, and President Truman said that we're going to make it our war, and he said those North Koreans are bad guys, and our good guys, General MacArthur, is over there, and he's going to protect us. And I said, well, let's go get them. But, you know, reflecting back on it now, just like we are today, reflecting back on the Iraq War, made all the sense in the world 3 years ago, didn't it? I mean, weren't we all gung-ho? You know, we're going to go after this Saddam guy, aren't we? Okay. Now, 3 years later, we look at it and say, well, I'm not so sure that was such a good idea. So I got to thinking about that Korean War, and I said, you know, here's a civil war between North and South Korea. I don't know which side was the more righteous side of the two. It's kind of like looking at the southern states and their war against the northern states, or the north against the south. Who was the more righteous of the two? And of course, if you're a Yankee from New York, you say, well, the Yankees were the righteous, and those dirty Alabamans and Mississippians and Southerners, they were all bad guys. And of course, you guys down in the South, you're all sitting there saying, no, it wasn't us guys, not in Alabama and Mississippi. All the bad guys were in Ohio and Indiana, trying to impose upon us their foreign and alien ideologies and so on. So, leaving that out of it, just looking at it pragmatically, what business did the United States of America have in interfering in somebody else's civil war? You'd have thought, you know, if the civil war in Korea was that important, we should have got more actively involved in the civil war in China, shouldn't we? Then there was this civil war that was going on between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. And here again, the Northerners wanted to unite with the South, and I guess the South didn't want to unite with the North. And so the Northerners said, well, we think we'll do it by force of arms. And we, the Americans, they told us, well, remember the domino theory? If North Vietnam conquers South Vietnam, then there will be a domino effect, and the communists are going to take over Laos and Cambodia and Malaysia and then India and then, you know, and then just on and on they'll go to Indonesia and so on. And it'll just be a domino effect. Well, now, we got involved, spent $100 billion, killed 58,000 guys, wounded another 100,000, and when it was all said and done, the North took over South Vietnam, and what happened to the domino theory? Hey, listen, those governments over there didn't fall like dominoes, did they? And even if they did, what difference does it make to us today? We've got diplomatic relations with the Vietnamese. We're over there buying, selling, and trading with the suckers. 30 years ago, we're over there fighting and killing them, and today we're over here buying, selling, and trading with them. What's that all about? Just business. Nothing personal. Just business. And hey, listen, as long as Bank of America and J.P. Morgan are happy, we can have peace. Other than that, you're going to get war. Bottom line, war is the result. Well, now, back before World War II, there was an amendment for peace. It was a proposal that we adopt this amendment in our Constitution. Now, after World War II, the Japanese adopted an amendment for peace, a peace amendment, a non-war amendment in their Constitution. Can you believe that? And listen, since World War II, the Japanese have not been involved in any wars since World War II. Now, we Americans, we don't have one of these amendments in our Constitution, and we've been involved in many, many wars since the end of World War II. Remember, that was the war to end all wars? Like World War I, the war to end all wars? I mean, that's an oxymoron, isn't it? Well, anyway, somebody came up and they proposed this amendment. Here's what it says. It says, I propose an amendment for peace to the Constitution of the United States. Number one, the removal of members of the land armed forces from within the continental limits of the United States and Panama Canal Zone for any cause whatsoever is prohibited. Two, the vessels of the United States Navy or of the other branches of the armed service are hereby prohibited from steaming for any reason whatsoever except on an errand of mercy more than 500 miles from our coast. And number three, aircraft of the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps is hereby prohibited from flying for any reason whatsoever more than 750 miles beyond the coast of the United States. Such an amendment would be an absolute guarantee to the women of America that their loved ones never would be sent overseas to be needlessly shot down in European or Asiatic or African wars that are of no concern to our people. Let me pause here for a moment. Let's analyze this for a minute. Let's suppose that we had an amendment like this in our Constitution like the Japanese have in theirs. And what it would boil down to is that we got this big, big problem over here in Darfur. And the United Nations is sitting over here saying, hey, we need to get involved in this Darfur thing. And we say, gee, we'd like to, but, you know, our Constitution prohibits that. You know, we can't get involved in Africa and Asia and Europe for any cause or reason. We've got a military establishment over here, but it's only for the defense of the United States of America. And we've got a Navy. You know, we could have a two-ocean navy, and our navy would sail out. How many miles? 500 miles? Let's see here. The vessels of the United States Navy are prohibited from steaming for any reason more than 500 miles from our coast. So, you know, they could go out 500 miles and steam up and down, but they wouldn't go over to Korea or Formosa, and they wouldn't be steaming around Japan or dinking around any place else in the world. They just go out there and kind of steam up and down our coasts. You know, that sounds like a pretty formidable defense. Now, we got a pretty good-sized Navy. The last time I heard, we had about 12 aircraft carriers. So, you know, we got 6 aircraft carriers out here in the Pacific and 6 aircraft carriers over here on the Atlantic coast, 500 miles from our coast, just steaming around, you know, just dinking around. And maybe they would steam maybe down around Houston and Galveston and on down to Brownsville and then steam around, you know, through the Gulf of Mexico in and out between the oil derricks and then maybe back up the Atlantic coast and turn around up there around Canada someplace and just kind of steaming around up and down there. Sounds like kind of a pretty formidable defense to me. Kind of like, you know, come and get it, guys. You know, if you're looking for a bitch for somebody, why don't you come and get it with us? And then just picture this Nazi Navy coming over here and they're going to attack New York and they're going to come through our Navy on the East Coast. I mean, we wouldn't have any ships over in protecting South Korea or North Korea or Japan or anybody else. All the Navy ships that we've got would just be here in the United States within 500 miles of our own borders. That'd be a pretty formidable force, don't you think? I can't imagine anybody in the world wanting to come over here and attack the United States. Okay, now let's take this other one here, the removal of members of the land armed forces from within the continental limits of the United States. We could have the very same thing that we've always had called the militias. And that's your National Guard. You know, all you guys that belong to the National Guard and you're over there in Iraq fighting, you know, we wouldn't have you over in Iraq or Afghanistan fighting anybody. We wouldn't waste the time of day. You guys would all be here in the United States working, doing whatever you're doing, going to your weekend meetings and one thing and another, and we wouldn't get into any kind of a fight until somebody actually came on our shores and started messing with our women and kids. And then we would say, okay, guys, time for us to go and kick some butt. And we're going to kick butt, and when we do it, we're going to be doing it in Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, maybe a little New York, maybe up and down the Atlantic or Pacific coast, maybe out in California, Washington, Oregon, maybe up in Alaska. But, you know, we're not gonna be out here messing with anybody else, messing around in their wars. And I imagine there would be a lot of bloody wars going on in the world and people killing each other all over the world. And that's tragic. And I feel real bad about that and one thing and another. But, you know, people have been killing each other all over the world for thousands of years. And we didn't get involved in those beefs, did we? So I looked at that Korean War, you know, from the perspective of a man who's now an old man, pushing 70, from the time when that war was going on and when it started when I was 11 years old. And I look back on it now and I say, you know, we got involved in a bitch that didn't belong to us. 50,000 Americans plus died over there for what reason? Because when it's all said and done, you got the same status quo that you had before. And if they had reunified the country, then you'd have one Korea, and it would be a communist Korea. So what? Just like you got a communist Vietnam. So what? I know it's a wild new concept, but here's a guy that came up with that idea, and he said, hey, I think this is a pretty good idea. I think we should have this written right into our Constitution. I don't think we should be involved in these foreign wars. He goes on to say, aircraft of the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps is hereby prohibited from flying for any reason whatsoever more than 750 miles from our coast. What do we need to fly out any further than that for? I mean, we could still have B-52s. I mean, if you want to, you could still have missiles if you want, you know. And we could be sitting over here in the United States saying, well, you know, this old Bill Clinton, old Bill comes up with some good ones once in a while. And he said, you know, the day that the North Koreans launch one of those nuclear weapons against the United States, the day before they launch that missile will have been the best day in their history. If we Americans had gone over to Iraq, I mean, just assuming, you know, that the Iraqis were behind the 9/11 attack, and you went over there and you just decimated their country, just bombed the thing right back into the Stone Age and then just left. To say, you know, tit for tat, you know. You knocked down two buildings and we took out three or four of your cities. Come on over, knock down a couple of more and then see what we do when we really get ticked off at you. I think you'd have a whole lot more credibility. Honest to God, I think the people listen to you more. Our president's over here threatening the North Koreans, threatening the Venezuelans, threatening the Iranians. Fighting with the Iraqis and fighting with the Afghanis over here. We're already stretched thin, boys and girls. You haven't got any more to go to war with. And you're getting stomped where you're at. And there's a reason why we're getting stomped, by the way. Our God is working against us. That's right. The God of Abraham's working against us. I'm not sure he's working for Allah, but he's not working for us. And that war over there in Iraq and Afghanistan, those are curses. Those aren't blessings. And they're great blessings, though, for Bechtel, Halliburton, you know, and Kellogg, Brown, and Root. They're making lots of money. But it's a curse to all the rest of us. Hey, we'll be back next time talking about this thing of war as a racket tomorrow night. Same time, same station. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide, daily, over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right here. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.